tonight, John comes to the podium with 34 years sobriety. And it's been a very active member at the NABA Club. And when I first came here, one of the first tasks I was asked to do is to record John's story for Annie B's birthday. I think I made several copies and passed them out, and next day everybody said, was there anything supposed to be on those CDs? So, John, I hope I can do a better job for you now. Welcome, John. Welcome back.
And I'm John, and I'm an alcoholic. My voice is a little not right tonight, so if you can't hear me, you can raise your hand if you want to. I am John, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm delighted to be here. You know, there was a wonderful fellow named George Montgomery who was a 40-year sober member of our fellowship and who passed on a few years back. And he used to always say, in case no one has told you today that they love you, let me be the first to tell you that I love each and every one of you. And I'm really feeling that tonight. And I don't usually start off by saying that, but it came out tonight. Thank each and every one of you for being here for me. Help me in my sobriety. And I want to apologize for walking out on Fred during How It Works. It was either walk out on him or walk out on you a little later. And I want to thank Fred for coming all the way down here from Gainesville and for the second time today. Thank you, Fred. My home group is the 11 a.m. Bridge Builders group right here. I see many of my friends from that group here and many other friends. And I attended my first meeting in this room back over in the far corner, back behind the curtain, as Tim said, just about 34 years ago. Thank you, Tim. Where are you, Tim? For asking me to do this tonight. I appreciate the honor. And again, thank all of you for being here. And in behalf of myself and everybody else here, Tim, I want to specifically thank you for your service to this meeting. Tim has been faithfully facilitating this Monday night meeting now for quite a long time. And it has become a mainstay here at NABA, thanks in large part to your efforts and encouragement. Thanks, Tim. And as I mentioned, I've got some long-term friends and sponsorees here, and I appreciate y'all turning out. They had to be here. The rest of you didn't, so thank you. I want to introduce a very good friend of mine and Marcy's named Ron Heber. Ron is sitting over here, and Ron is one of our pastors at our church. He's a wonderful guy, and he's the go-to guy if you need someone to be there for you in ministry when the times get tough. This is Ron's first visit to an AA meeting. Thanks for coming, Ron. And then, there's Marcy. We just celebrated 21 months of marriage, and it gets better every day. And since I was fortunate enough to partner with this lady, everybody pays a lot more attention to me, and I love it. And, of course, we all know that it doesn't have anything to do with the cookies and the banana pudding. I grew up in Richmond, Virginia. My father was a preacher and a professor of theology at a Presbyterian seminary. My mother was also a very highly educated woman. And in addition to other things, she was trained as a church organist. They were, in fact, wonderful people. Loved, admired, and they gave great and loving service in the world. I was many years sober in AA before I became able and willing and realized that truth about them and finally accepted it and then gratefully finally embraced it. thanks to AA, I've been very close to both of my parents in AA, and I was blessed with over 20 years sober in AA to share time with my father, and even more with my mother, who passed away in 2008 at the age of 103. Back in the day, though, when I was in the fourth or fifth grade, mother found out that I had been using some naughty language at school. So every day after that, when I got home from school, I had to tell her if I had said any naughty words. I came home one day, and she said, "John, did you say any naughty words at school today?" So I finally admitted, "Yes, I said one." She made me tell her what it was. I did, and then she proceeded to wash out my mouth with soap. At that time, I came to the conclusion that there was no benefit to telling the truth. So I stopped trying to do that. As early as 8 or 9 years old, maybe 10 years old, I was living two lives. The person I really was, but I kept secret and on the inside, and the person I really wasn't, but tried to show to you on the outside. I got busted by my mother all the time. I never got by with anything, even though I tried real hard. And she would turn me over to my dad, who would administer the punishment most of the time with a leather razor strap. I knew clearly what my parents' attitude towards drinking, smoking, carousing was. Any good Christian boy would use his willpower to resist such things. Thus, when the day came when I finally did take my first drink at age 17, when I was a senior in high school, I felt guilty, ashamed, and full of fear before I even took that first pull on a friend's beer. I went home that night drunk and sick. My priorities in life changed that night. My attitude and outlook changed. My primary purpose changed. Drinking became the number one focus of my life, and everything else took second place. Family, my sweet little blonde girlfriend Nancy, who later became my wife and the mother of my kids. Ambitions in life, and most of the moral principles that I still had left. I became alienated from and resentful of my family. I could not wait to get as far away from home as possible and go off to college the next year. So, with drinking and self-gratification as my primary purpose, it was amazing how fast I became an expert at gratifying those desires. A year later, I was 400 miles away from home at a little Presbyterian college in North Carolina called Davidson College, and I had progressed to the point where I drank almost every night. In my sophomore year, I dropped out of my fraternity boarding house so I could take the $25 a month that Mom and Dad sent me to eat on at the boarding house and spend it on beer instead. In order to pull this off, I literally ate Vienna sausage and saltine crackers in my dorm room every night for food. There was a place called the Anchor Grill up the road, which was my go-to place for my drinking when I was in college. And I got to know the owner so well during this time that he gave me a job part-time, two nights a week, tending bar. But I always went home owing him more than he owed me. I was put on academic probation at the end of my sophomore year in the spring of 1960. Y'all can figure that out if you want to. So I decided to drop out of college instead of going to summer school to get reinstated. I got a job out west, this far away from home type thing. I got a job out west in Idaho with the U.S. Forest Service, out in the wilderness. But before I left, I stole a driver's license and a draft card from a good friend of mine on the dorm so that I would have ID to buy drinks out west that summer. 18 years later, when I wrote this guy a Ninth Step amends letter, I got back one of the most forgiving and encouraging letters I've ever received. I had a few local drinking buddies, not guys in college, local guys, that I met at the Anchor Grill. And on the last day before I left to go to Idaho, one of them was coming to pick me up, and we were going to drive in his car to Charlotte to have a going-away drinking bash. He was so drunk on the way to pick me up that he ran off the road and was killed. We heard the sirens from the police cars and the ambulance from the Anchor, and I'd already had plenty to drink, and I remember just sitting there continuing to drink for the rest of the day and frankly not having too many thoughts one way or the other about what had just happened. 6 months later, after I had returned home to Richmond and now I had a job driving a Coca-Cola truck, I met another drinking friend. You'll notice that this meeting of drinking friend comes up kind of regularly in my story. I had another drinking friend, and we arranged to meet at a local bar to get together for a wild evening. He never showed up. He was killed in a car accident on the way to meet me. The irony and the tragedy and the warning of these two experiences escaped my conscious comprehension until I'd been sober in AA for a number of years. I didn't go to either funeral. I don't recall having any particular feelings one way or other about what happened, and I didn't have many thoughts about either one of these guys for years afterwards. I was emotionally and spiritually dead, and I was 20 years old. Driving a Coca-Cola truck was hard work with low pay, and I decided that it was incompatible with my need for much more money, much less work, more time to drink, and especially the image that I wanted you to have of me. So I finished college. And then I convinced my patient and long-suffering little blonde girlfriend, Nancy, to marry me. And immediately after college, we went off to the U.S. Army for 3 years on active duty, where I was an officer, not a gentleman, but an officer, and an Army aviator. While we were in the Army, we had two beautiful children. I had 10 more years of active drinking to do after we got out of the Army and moved to Atlanta in 1966 when I was going to start my business career at one of the local banks. I was already living on borrowed time and escaping the just and reasonable consequences of my dangerous and addictive choices in life. Nancy and I bought a little brick three-bedroom bungalow over in Clarkston on a VA loan and settled into our new life. Here it comes again. It didn't take me long to find a new drinking buddy at the bank named Fred. Soon Fred and I were out every night after work, drinking and carousing and coming home drunk at all hours of the night, scaring our wives to death. We didn't care about them or our kids. We just wanted to party and have a good time. Fred was a little guy, sort of a cross between Danny DeVito and Joe Pesci. You know, that comparison is getting kind of old. There's a lot of people around that don't know who those two guys are anymore. Anyway, Fred liked to go down on Auburn Avenue to the black folks' honky-tonk to have a good time. This was in the middle of the 1960s, in the middle of the Civil Rights Revolution. It scared me to death But all those black folks down there, they just loved him to death, and we all had a wonderful time, or so we thought. One morning, we woke up in a motel room with no recollection of where we'd been the night before or what we had done the night before. That's the way life was for these two church-going family men with professional jobs at the local bank. One night I had tickets to take my family downtown Atlanta to the Omni to see the famous Russian gymnast Olga Korbut. Fred and I stayed out drinking too late, and I came roaring in drunk almost too late to get the family downtown to get in our seats on time. Nancy did not want to put the kids in the car with me. She begged me to let her drive. I was having none of it, and I herded her and the kids into the car and sped off downtown. We got to our seats just as the performance was starting, but I decided I needed a beer. So I got my oldest son, Jay, to come with me. We went to the concession stand to get a beer. On the way back to our seats, I stumbled on the steps, fell down, spilled the beer all over the person who was sitting just behind us, my son Jay, standing there watching the whole thing. Many years later, after Nancy and I had been divorced, but still on very close and friendly terms as we are today, she told me that once when Jay was 7 or 8 years old, he came to her and he said, "Mom, how come Daddy never plays with me the way the other dads play with their kids?" I can remember sitting on the sofa at night, sending Jay off to the refrigerator every 15 minutes to get me another beer. And I'd be sitting next to my beautiful daughter, Beth, and every now and then this overwhelming urge to just reach out, put my arms around her, hug her, say, "Beth, I love you. You come over me." But I was frozen, and I could not do it. Nancy would say, "John, please stop drinking." My response to that, "I can stop drinking anytime I want to. I just don't want to." Meanwhile, my business career prospered. I was good at bluffing my way through the necessary things in life. And I got recruited by a New York investment firm to set up a local Atlanta office. So we bought a bigger house, had a third baby, and I became an officer of the church. Here's this two lives things going on. I traveled a lot, and all of my work associates were in New York. I became a loner and loved being on the road, so I could drink and carouse away from anybody who knew me. A few years after that, another local investment company recruited me to an even better job. But that job put me in a position of having to dress up and go downtown to an office every day. My pattern of isolation and drinking were well established by that time, and it never did work out all that well at that company, because the consequences of my behavior began to become obvious to the people around me, and my job performance became less and less satisfactory. I was a constant drunk driver. It never occurred to me that I could not drive drunk. I had years of close calls, but I had no arrests or accidents until it finally began to catch up with me. I reached the point where I was a blackout, solitary, anonymous drinker seeking lower places and lower people. One night I started out drinking at a bar at around 10th and Peachtree Street. I went into a blackout, and I came 2 hours later at a bar down south of the airport, seated at a table, and there were 6 other people there that I'd never seen before. They invited me to come with them to a house party. But before we got there, I went into another blackout. I woke up the next morning on the floor wrapped in a blanket, And those people were not being as nice to me as they had been the night before. So I hit the road out of there as fast as I could. But on the way out of the driveway, the rear bumper of my car caught on a chain link fence. I pulled it down and dragged the fence halfway up the block before I finally fell off. By some miracle, I actually made it to work that day. But I was terrified the whole day long that the cops would bust in and take me off in handcuffs. In January of 1976, I received a call from my dear old friend Fred. Fred had moved to Savannah years before, and I had not seen him in a long, long time. He was coming to Atlanta on business and wanted to come by and see me. I was thrilled, and I had plenty of booze and beer ready for when he got there. I offered him a beer or a drink when he got there, but he politely refused. I already had a start, and I got another one for myself. We sat down, and Fred told me the story of his drinking nightmare in Savannah. He lost his business. He almost lost his family. He went bankrupt and off to jail numerous times. But Fred looked different. Happy, healthy, peaceful. He reached into his pocket and he pulled out a green poker chip and showed it to me and told me that he had received it for his 9-month sobriety date at a place called Alcoholics Anonymous. He said AA had helped him to stop drinking, and he just wanted to share his good news about that with me. He never said anything to me about my drinking. Then he said he needed to go, got up, gave me a hug, and left. Years later, I found out that Fred didn't have another appointment in town that day. He made the trip all the way to Atlanta just to see me. Fred's carrying of the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to me saved my life. At first, though, I did everything I could think of to prove that I was not like Fred and that I did not need any help to stop drinking. I could stop any time I wanted to. I would just control my drinking. So, I tried everything I could think to do that. Only drink beer. Only drink liqueur. That's a bad idea. Drink only at night. Drink only on weekends. Drink only during the week. I only got worse. A lot of y'all know that story. About a month after Fred came to see me, I was out again cruising and drinking and driving around the seedy parts of Atlanta in my nice company car, and I went into a blackout and got lost. When I came to, I was curb bound on a side street that I had never seen before. And I was gunning the accelerator and shifting the gears rapidly back and forth between forward and reverse, trying to rock myself off of the curb. No luck. I realized that there was a cop car behind me. The cop got out, came and put me in handcuffs, and then put me in the cage in the back seat of his car. While we were waiting for the paddy wagon to come get me, my car burst into flames and then exploded. All my rocking had superheated the metal undercarriage. If the cop had not been there, I would have died in that explosion. I spent that night in the old Grady lockup and the old Atlanta City jail drunk tank. My boss then was CEO of the company. He should have fired me many times over, but confrontation was not his thing, and he just ignored my poor job performance, late arrivals, early departures, and other unexplained behaviors. I conjured up a cock and bull story about how my car burned up, And he accepted it and said, go ahead and order another one. So, the dealer tag was still on my brand new yellow 1976 Buick LeSabre with a tan vinyl top on the night of April the 27th, 1976. When, after an evening of late work with the company auditors, followed by some drinking at a local bar, I ran a stop sign at 17th and Spring Street straight into the path of an oncoming taxi cab. The cab T-boned me going about 45 miles an hour, knocked me across the intersection up against the telephone pole. One of the company auditors was with me in the shotgun seat, and there were five people in the taxi. We all walked away from the accident, but both cars were totaled. Both doors on my cars were bashed shut, and we had to wait and sit in there until they came to pry us out. While I was trapped in my seat, and with all the commotion going on outside, I had the first moment of clarity about my drinking and my life that I had ever had. I said in my mind, God, please help me. I can't do this anymore. I'm going to go to that place that Fred told me about and ask them to help me stop drinking. That was 4 months after Fred had come to visit me. I was almost 36 years old, and I had been drinking for 18 and a half years. By God's grace, and with the help of you folks and many hundreds of other folks just like you, I have not had another drink since that night. Thank God, and thanks to AA, that all three of my wonderful children and all four of my wonderful grandchildren and my wonderful former wife, Nancy, love me and respect me and want me in their lives today. My young son, Phil, was 5 years old when I got sober. None of my grandchildren has ever seen me drunk. I was fortunate to still have my job when I got to AA. The job required a fair amount of travel, and I managed to stay off the road for the first 90 days I was in the fellowship. Traveling and being alone and anonymous in other cities was a major drinking trigger for me. But the day came when I had to go to Houston on business, and I was very nervous about how I would behave on the road. My sponsor, Hubert, and I carefully researched AA meetings and picked one that was near the motel where I was staying. I checked into the motel, and I had plenty of time to find the church where the meeting was. I arrived at the church over 30 minutes early, and the parking lot was empty, so I sat in the car, said the serenity prayer, and breathed deeply. There were no cell phones in those days to call your sponsor or your AA buddies. I went into the church and I couldn't find anybody. Returning to my car, I didn't know what I should do. I began to think about the people in my home group, and I would have given almost anything if even one of them had been there to talk with me. About that time, the car pulled up, and then another, and then another, and folks began to go inside. So I went in myself, I found where they were, and it was AA. Those people welcomed me happily and took care of me for the rest of the night. I totally forgot that I was now in the Central Time Zone. I was over an hour and a half early to that meeting. This was one of the most valuable early experiences I had in AA. I became vividly aware of the tremendous gift in Alcoholics Anonymous of an alcoholic to of another understanding alcoholic to help each other stay sober. I realized this was exactly what had happened to Bill Wilson in the Mayflower Hotel in Akron, Ohio in 1935. After about a year and a half in AA, my life and my circumstances had begun to come back together, and all the consequences and wreckage of my drinking were in the past. So I told Hubert that I really loved AA, but that I was real busy at work and in my family now, and I would not have as much time to go to meetings as I had been having. Hubert thought for a moment. He always thought before he said something, and I'm still trying to learn how to do that. He thought for a moment, and he said, "John, AA's literature does not say that AA is our only purpose. It says it is our primary purpose." I had to learn that lesson again after many years of sobriety. After about 12 years in AA, I went about 2 years without going to a meeting. I developed a serious and dangerous dry drunk. The consequences to me were that when I came to the point where I had lapsed away from my AA meetings and AA relationships, I did not have the spiritual resources to avoid slipping back into almost all of my character defects. I am grateful that I returned to AA without drinking, but I cannot say that AA principles were anywhere evident in my life at that time. I did not drink, but I sure did stink. After that long dry drunk, I returned to AA with renewed passion and commitment to the fellowship and also to our wonderful 12-step program of recovery. In my first year of AA, I had honestly worked the 12 steps with my sponsor, Huber. I had been fully grounded in the surrender of step one. I had received enormous benefits from the inventory steps 4 and 5 and the amend steps 8 and 9. However, I can see now that for years I had been paying less and less attention to practicing the principles, and that frankly I had been staying sober on the basis of personal relationships and fellowship. I was practicing personalities over principles, rather than principles over personalities, as we have in our 12th tradition about anonymity. I have forgotten the line in the big book which says, "We are given a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition." I did have a God of my understanding, but I had turned him into a Bush League pinch hitter. That's a phrase out of our book, 12 Steps and 12 Traditions in AA. I turned him into a Bush League pinch hitter. I failed to place the God of my understanding first in my life. About a year after I returned to AA, I was asked to lead a meeting on step 6, which says we were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. So I studied and prepared and began to give my discussion comments in the meeting. While I was sharing about all the work I had done to get over my character defects, it finally dawned on me and came to me that step 6 and 7 are not about my character defects, and they're not about anything I can do to fix myself. They are about reconnecting with the spiritual attitude of steps 1, 2, and 3. This attitude is well expressed in AA's 3 pertinent ideas that we hear every day at the end of How It Works: that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism, that God could and would if he were sought. Sometimes in AA we shorten this up even further and just say, "Let go and let God." When I was drinking, my primary purpose was to drink and to fulfill my own selfish and self-centered desires for myself. By practicing that behavior, what materialized for me and my family was chaos, heartbreak, anger, alienation, misery. As an active member of AA, whose primary purpose is to stay sober and help others, what materializes for me is peace, serenity, contentment, happiness, loving relationships. I'm grateful to be able to say that thanks to AA, I am now living the happiest years in my life. I have a loving God whom I have learned to put first in all things. I have sobriety. I have the steps. I have a wonderful new wife, Marcy, who loves me and supports me in my AA journey. I have a loving family. I have wonderful friends in AA, including special people, and there's some of you here tonight, who share with me on a very deep and personal level. As my sponsor Hubert said all those many years ago, I know my primary purpose. May the God of your understanding bless each of you here tonight as you continue in recovery. And I really appreciate the opportunity to share with you here tonight.
Thank you, Dad. I was amazed before you were halfway through. Still in? The seventh tradition states that there are no dues or fees for AA membership. But your generosity is greatly appreciated. If you don't have anything to put in the basket, that's quite okay with it, because I've been there many times. But if you have a little extra, it goes to the good. I asked Mark to give out the chips.
Thank you, John, for telling your story. It's very inspiring. Here at the Monday night Blue Chip speaker meeting, AA, we have a tip system which represents the length of time you got sober. First tip is just for today. Silver chip is for 30 days. Red chip is for 90 days. Yellow chip is 6 months. Green. All right. All right. We have a green chip for 9 months, blue chip for a year multiples. If anyone would like to consider trying out where we're living just for today, pick a white chip. Give us up a hand for the chip you hold.
Thank you, Mark. Great job. Congratulations on 6 months. That's big. Real big. Okay, do we have any AA related announcements?
My name is Mark. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Mark. You bet.
Sunday, August 22nd, we have a 5th year anniversary of the men's barbecue. We have a barbecue here. So it'll be on a Sunday at noon. All of us will meet it, women and children. It starts at 12. It's called $7 a ticket. If you want any more information, see that at the meeting. And it's over. Speaker meeting the same day at 2 o'clock. And I have a key to the literature gathering if anyone like me with A literature. Thank you.
Okay, see you all for your AA literature after the meeting. And again, that's Sunday, the 22nd, 12 o'clock for the picnic, and 2 o'clock for a seat.
It's a park.
And it's a park. And 55 years of experience, pretty good barbecue. Okay. Anybody else?
Well, next week, our speaker should be prepared because I had set out the wrong date to work. And, I apologize, Joey.
Oh, okay.
Well, you'll be ready, I'm sure. So,
and then, okay, we're all looking forward to that. And then the following week, on the 23rd, there's a young man, he's 19 years old. He's got 4 years, picked up his 4 year show. And he's from Gainesville. At the Freedom Club, or the Freedom Group at the Hawk Club. And man, when he picked that chip up, I've never seen anybody who glowed like he did. So I hope you bring some of that magic down here. I was amazed that he was 19 years old. And he's really working the program. So we're going to have to get a little step to understand that. He's really tough. He's a ball of fire. Okay. Anything else? All right. Somewhere. We're going to close the meeting. Right here. Okay. Oh, any volunteers to help clean up? Volunteers? Great. Thanks. Appreciate it. I'd like to remind everybody that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities, and for those who will, please join us in the Lord's Prayer. Jim, I got a call on you again.
Okay. Moment of silence. Imagine that this is the perfect circle here. Something here to take out. Take a deep breath.
Go ahead and fill them out. Just one, you can find. Thank you.